This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, January 30th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. It's not a done deal until all the deals are done, but Brexit is happening, finally. So how does Great Britain's departure from the European Union change myriad relationships for both the EU and Britain? And is there reason to believe more illiberal policies might emerge from a newly independent Great Britain? Cato's Ryan Bourne comments. A lot of people thought even after this referendum went through that the way that Great Britain had behaved following the referendum, that this was just not going to happen. What changed recently that made Brexit a more secure proposition?
Well, that's right. And this is the kind of third Brexit exit date that we've had, and it looks like third time's a charm. When the UK originally voted to leave in the referendum, after an extended period of time of thinking about how the UK government would approach the negotiations, they eventually triggered Article 50 in March 2017, and that gave 2 years for the EU and the UK to negotiate what's described as a withdrawal agreement to kind of settle up on financial contributions outstanding from the UK, decide what both sides wanted to do about citizens' rights in their countries, and to think about the Irish border issue. And the simple truth is that after that, both sides did negotiate a withdrawal agreement under Prime Minister Theresa May, but it was completely unacceptable to Parliament, both to Remain supporters and the strongest supporters of Brexit. It tried to compromise on what Brexit actually was, keep the UK very close to the European Union, and both sides rejected that, so it had no parliamentary majority. Now, Boris Johnson then became Prime Minister as a result of that towards the back end of last year. And he came in with a very clear position, which was that he wanted to leave the European Union with or without a withdrawal agreement and was unwilling to extend the deadline for Brexit beyond what was reasonable for him to deliver on that mandate. Parliament tried to bind his hands. They delayed Brexit again. It was supposed to happen on October the 31st. But eventually they kind of ran out of road, and Boris was able to trigger a general election with the support of the other parties. And in that election, he won pretty much a thumping landslide. He had a very clear position that he wanted to deliver Brexit, and the Labour Party kind of didn't really know what its position was, tried to straddle both Leave and Remain voters, and as a result, kind of fell through the middle. So Boris has now got a big majority of 80, and as a result of that, his revised withdrawal agreement has completely sailed through Parliament. Yesterday sailed through the European Union on Wednesday afternoon. And so as a result, Brexit is going to happen. It's going to happen on Friday, the 31st of January at 11 p.m.
Just so we're all clear, how does this change the relationship between Great Britain and the European Union?
Well, the immediate consequences are not particularly profound economically. When Brits and Europeans wake up on the 1st of February, they probably won't even notice that the UK has left the European Union. And that's because as a result of this withdrawal agreement, both parties then enter what is known as a transition phase, which lasts through, scheduled to last through at the moment, to the end of December. And during that phase, the UK will remain part of the EU's single market and customs union. Business trading arrangements will remain unchanged. Britain will still be subject to all the regulations of the European Union, any new regulations that are developed in that period, and free movement of people will by and large continue. Now, this transition phase is supposed to facilitate time for both sides to agree on a kind of longer term free trade agreement. And Boris Johnson has been pretty clear. He wants that to be a kind of ordinary free trade agreement. He doesn't want the UK to be part of the EU's economic institutions. But that doesn't mean the withdrawal date on Friday is not a profound moment, because what it really kind of represents is Britain's constitutional exit from the European Union. And what that means is that now, when negotiating those future economic partnerships, security partnerships and the like, Britain will be doing so as a third country. It won't be a kind of whinging backseat driver in a political club anymore. It will be steering its own destiny and determining what sorts of economic relations it wants with the EU in line with its own interests.
So how does this change the internal politics there? I can either just a day or so ago, I heard Nigel Farage saying, this will give politicians like me nowhere to hide. That is, we can no longer hide behind the dictates or complain about the European Parliament. We can't complain about that anymore. Our fate is our own, and we can't hide behind that. Is that fair?
I think that's right. I think Brexit, if you look at most of the surveys of why people voted for it, it was just a basic idea, really, that they wanted the laws that they were governed under to be made by people who were directly accountable to them. So I think even for economists who favoured Brexit, like I did, Brexit was always kind of a bet that the UK's institutions, not least its kind of flexible parliamentary democracy, which tends to adapt quite quickly to new situations, would on net tend to deliver better outcomes in a changing world than more and more centralised powers with a kind of Brussels technocracy. Now, whether that's true or not, of course, will take years to assess. It's certainly the case that at the moment, British politics seem to be drifting in a more collectivist direction. But I'd argue that that predates the Brexit moment kind of entirely. So it's quite difficult to strip out, you know, the natural trends or the political trends that we've seen anyway, and how much they have been caused by Brexit. But of course, in the longer term, this ultimately is a constitutional decision. It doesn't prejudge what sorts of policies the UK adopts in trade and migration and regulation, agriculture, fishing, and a whole range of other things outside. And it's up to economic liberals now to make the case for economic openness in a world which, of course, is becoming more and more protectionist and interventionist.
With respect to the internal politics and the classical liberal libertarian policies we might like to see Britain adopt going forward, do any of those become more difficult? That is to say, was the European Union as an overarching body, were there some pro-liberal policies that Great Britain is less likely to have on the books going forward?
Well, it's certainly true that the EU is a mixed blessing in regard to classical liberalism. Evidently, the achievement of pretty much free movement of people, capital, goods, and to a lesser extent, services, because the single market in services was never really complete. That is quite an achievement from a liberal perspective. The EU had taken steps to kind of restrict countries from engaging in overt state aid, subsidizing national champions and particular industries. So in that regard, Brexit does mean that the UK has more degrees of freedom, and that brings both risks and opportunities. But then on the flip side, you know, the EU is quite often outwardly protectionist and probably increasingly going in that direction. And we're kind of seeing that in the way that the EU Commission has attacked the big tech companies, for example. There's a big push for a kind of more tax harmonization at an EU level. And of course, from a trade perspective, the EU has often imposed quite a lot of non-tariff barriers to the importation of goods from particularly poorer countries as well. So Brexit in itself gives the UK more degrees of freedom. How it uses those freedoms will determine ultimately whether Brexit is a success or not. Now, at the moment, it kind of certainly looks like British politics is drifting in a more interventionist, kind of mercantilistic direction. But I'd argue a lot of that predated Brexit and predated the Brexit vote. So it's quite difficult to disentangle how much of this kind of drift we'd have seen anyway, and how much of it is related to Brexit. What I think we have to separate out here, and why this Friday is really important, is what it's really about is a constitutional decision mandated by the British people to repatriate a whole range of policy powers. And how those policy powers are used is kind of a secondary question. Brexit for Brexiteer economists was always a bet that over time, over the long run, the UK's institutions, its kind of flexible, quite accountable parliamentary democracy, would tend on net to deliver better outcomes to ever-changing circumstances than a centralised Brussels technocracy. And whether that's true or not, of course, will take years to assess.
Is there any reason to expect that the United States' relationship with either the European Union or Great Britain will change? I can remember, I believe it was Barack Obama saying, look, when I pick up the phone, I want to be able to call Europe. And now that's at least two phone calls, isn't it?
Yeah, it's certainly true that for a long time, kind of official State Department policy under both Republican and Democratic presidents has been to favor a strong European Union with the UK inside the European Union. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I think that the US has often seen the UK as quite a liberalizing voice when it comes to economic issues. And obviously, due to quite a close-knit defense and security relationship, it kind of helps to have quite a sympathetic, a voice in the EU that's sympathetic to American needs and wants. I do think it could change the relationship somewhat. Evidently, at the moment, there's a big desire on the part of the Trump administration and Boris Johnson's administration to make some sort of free trade deal between the UK and the US. Now, how much that will actually what the actual components of that will be, I think may well be constrained by domestic UK politics, particularly in regards to areas such as agriculture. But I think the Trump administration has actually been keen to get that going sooner rather than later. The UK government seemed to be in the past few months a bit more reticent because I don't think they want to sign a deal that might prejudice the sort of deal that they're able to negotiate with the European Union. So now it seems as if they're prioritising that EU trade relationship. I think within the EU, there are certainly lots of kind of voices hostile to what's perceived to be the Anglo-Saxon model of capitalism. And in areas like tech policy and some issues pertaining to antitrust and competition policy, I think the UK being outside of the EU may make life more difficult on the margin for American companies in dealing with the EU Commission.
Ryan Bourne occupies Cato's R. Evan Scharf Chair for the Public Understanding of Economics. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.